Welcome to Manny's, a people-powered, community-minded space at the corner of 16th and Valencia in the Mission. On a typical Friday night, Manny's is buzzing with music, political discussions, and a roster of speakers and performers. But these days, like most businesses, Manny's is closed to the public. Instead, they are presenting a series of virtual conversations with local leaders and thinkers who are trying to make sense of this moment and how we will recover. To keep you civically engaged while we are sheltered in place, KALW is airing a new Welcome to Manny's every Friday evening. Tonight, founder Manny Akutiel talks with possible vice presidential candidate Stacey Abrams about her work on voting rights, how the pandemic is changing campaigns, and her favorite Star Trek captain. And now, welcome to Manny's.
Welcome, Stacey Abrams.
Manny, thank you so much. Manny was telling me a little bit earlier that he launched his small business on the night of the election in 2018, November 6, 2018, a day that is etched in my memory. And the end of that night at 1 a.m., I went downstairs not to declare victory or to concede defeat. My job that night was to tell people that I knew there had been voter suppression activities across the state, and it was my job to keep fighting until every vote was counted. For the next 10 days, that's the work we did. We were able to fight and get thousands of ballots counted. We were able to uncover shenanigans and terrible actions that were designed simply to steal the voices from other Georgians. By the end of the 10-day period, I had gone through all of the stages of grief. I spent a long time investing in anger, got really comfortable there, but I realized that that wasn't a place I could stay. For me, the seven stages weren't enough. I needed to add an eighth stage. I call that stage plotting. I wanted to think about what I could do next. I was going to have a lot of time on my hands because by then we realized that when your opponent is the person who is in charge of the election, he's the referee, the contestant, and the scorekeeper, he's probably going to win. And so in that 10-day period, I really turned my mind away from the question of what happened to me and really focused on the question of what was happening to our country, what was happening to the people in our state, especially those who had not voted before. We turned out more voters than any Democrat in Georgia history, including more than 700,000 people who had never participated in a midterm election before. That meant something, because it meant that when we talked about the values, when we talked about the possibilities, when we talked about opportunity, they believed and they were willing to risk their hope to try and make it real. But at the end of the day, voter suppression had its way. And thousands of people were silenced. Thousands of people were told they didn't matter in our state. Well, in that 10-day period, I thought about what work could I do if I didn't have the title of governor. I launched a few organizations because I had 10 whole days. And so I focused on the census because I understood that the census is going to be how we allocate economic power and political power for the next decade. I focused on the economic resilience in the South, knowing that the progressive policies we need to see were not going to come from the governor of Georgia. And so I wanted to figure out how do we translate progressive into Southern. But most fundamentally, I wanted to restore and expand access to the power of the vote. And that was called Fair Fight. We immediately turned my campaign around and we shifted resources and we moved it into Fair Fight because I knew that what happened in Georgia was wrong, not just because I didn't get a title, but because people didn't get their choice. And in a democracy, you don't always win, but you have the right to be a participant. And people in our state were denied that right. We launched Fair Fight Action and we started to grow it. We realized that what was happening in Georgia, while it was singular, we were not the only ones. That across this country, voter suppression had taken root in the last 20 years. What used to be guns and hoses and bulk, what used to be demonization of people through law had become demonization of voters through process. They were using the administrative processes of registration. Can you register and stay on the rolls? Can you cast a ballot? Can your ballot be counted? They were taking those processes and using them against the very people who were entitled to use it. What we saw happen in Georgia happened in Ohio. It happened in Wisconsin. It happened in Michigan, in Arizona, in Texas. It happened in Florida. And across this country, the only way we are going to see change is if we change from the inside. I've been a Democrat my entire life. I didn't realize it was an option, much like, you know, my faith when I was growing up. There are certain things you were just told you are. But I remain a Democrat because I believe in who we are. Fair Fight Action is a nonpartisan organization, but Fair Fight 2020 does take a very specific political lens, because I recognize that for the last 20 years, the architect of voter suppression have been Republicans. It's been conservative leaders who've used the power of government to turn government against its people. And that is wrong. Because when you break the machinery of democracy, no matter who your intended target is, everyone suffers. And we have no clearer evidence of that than what's happening in the midst of this pandemic. The incompetence and chaos we see at the top of the leadership ladder in America is playing out in the state of Georgia, where we have a governor who would rather put people's lives at risk than risk offending the president. We see it happening in Texas. We see it happening across this country as the most vulnerable are pushed deeper into the shadows, and those who want power to continue are willing to steal our elections to make it happen. We saw that happen in Wisconsin, where people were told to go and risk their lives if they wanted to participate in the election. Five men on the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as the state legislature of Wisconsin, said that the people didn't matter, the power did. Well, Fair Fight Action, Fair Fight 2020, we exist because we believe in the people. We believe that the people have the right to be heard and that we can build the infrastructure to defend that right. Because we started this organization, we've been able to anticipate some of the worst actions. Now, I will tell you, I did not anticipate COVID-19. I knew there would be some terrible things happening. I knew there would be an intensity of suppression, but I did not expect there to be a pandemic that would be then used as a justification for stealing the right to vote. Because this year, voting is about survival. We have seen what happens when we hire incompetence, when we are led by someone who is hell-bent on sowing chaos and lying to the people. We've seen when we have state-level leaders who, rather than protecting the people they were hired to serve, try to serve their political futures. And we've seen what happens when our people do not have the right to vote in safe environments. Wisconsin has already reported a number of people who contracted COVID because they had to stand in line, but they understood they were fighting for their future. Thank you so much.
First, before we get to questions, hello, welcome, friends, family, future boyfriends, and husbands for me. Thank you. And you and Stacey, we're looking, we're single, we're ready. All right, first question, Stacey, is how you doing? How are you? And what has shelter in place been like for Stacey Abrams?
Well, I'm sitting in my new studio, which is my dining room.
Okay.
Okay. I have ring light and everything. I've been privileged to be a part of moving some of the most critical issues that our nation faces forward. Mm-hmm. In addition to the work with Fair Fight, I have an organization called Fair Count that is working to ensure that hard to count communities are included in the census. And in the midst of COVID-19, making sure that those communities are seen and heard is going to be even more crucial because there is such an active approach by the Trump administration to erase them from the story of America. I have an organization called the Southern Economic Advancement Project, and we've been working with the hardest hit COVID patients and COVID families, those who are at or below the poverty line, who aren't getting their stimulus checks because they're unbanked, who need to know where resources are. And so we've built a 12-state network of providing information, but we're partnering with great organizations to get resources and information out. And then, of course, Fair Fight. So I haven't had a lot of time for downtime.
She's busy.
But my parents raised me with three pillars: faith, family, and service. My faith tells me that the work I'm doing is my responsibility. Mm-hmm. My family tells me that the work we're doing is living out the credo that my parents raised us with and the ethic they raised us with. And service for me is life. It's how I wake up and how I go to sleep, because I know that I'm doing what I can to help serve people and fix the problems that we see. But I've also gotten an extra amount of time to start watching some more TV because I love television.
Ooh.
And I'm catching up on my very tall stack of books that I'm reading. And so, you know, I'm trying to get everything in, but the work comes first.
What is one positive habit that you've picked up by being required to stay in your home? And what's one thing you've learned about yourself, Stacey?
So during the campaign, I started using the Calm app. And you might imagine I kind of fell off.
Why? Oh, yeah. Okay. Election. Right. Got it.
He's got a little busy.
Yeah.
And now every morning when I wake up, I make myself take that 10, 15 minutes just to sit, to meditate, which is not something I'd done before with any regularity. And it really has an effect. It's not only the, you know, not to do an ad for them. It's not just the calm. It's the space to really think about what I am going to do in the day without focusing on the thing itself, really focusing on being ready to meet the thing, whatever it is.
Totally. Absolutely. I've been using Headspace. So we're meditation buddies.
There you go.
And what's one thing you've learned about yourself throughout all this?
I really am an introvert. I've talked to friends who were going stir crazy. I do not have that problem.
You're okay right now.
I'm good. I love my family. I love my friends. I'm happy to touch base. I despise the creator of Zoom. No. I mean, he's probably, or she is probably a good person, but I'm okay.
Okay, great. Okay. We're going to have a little bit of fun, kind of. I'm going to say three words and then I'd like you to please say the first thing that comes to mind.
No.
I haven't even started yet.
Fine. Go ahead.
Okay. So you're ready?
Sure.
Okay. Quarantine.
Georgia.
2020.
Elections.
Movie.
Star Trek.
Amazing.
I just saw Star Trek Beyond again. I love it.
Which one's that one?
Oh, it's
the most recent one?
It's not the most recent one. It's okay.
Is that the one with the bald captain? I'm sorry, I'm failing right now.
Which one is that one? So that's Picard that we love.
Okay. But
Star Trek Beyond is one of the reboots of the original Star Trek in movie form.
Okay. I like the one with the woman captain.
Voyager. She is my favorite. I love Captain Picard as the, see, I'm about to go into a spiral.
Okay. I like the woman captain. That was my favorite. What was her name?
Captain Janeway.
Okay. Awesome. I'm going to brush up on my Star Trek for the next call we do.
Okay.
All right, so let's get to some serious stuff. I opened up a small business in San Francisco called Manny's. I did name it after myself. So what it is, Stacey, is we combined a nonprofit restaurant which hires formerly homeless and formerly incarcerated individuals with a political bookshop, a cafe, a bar, and a civic event space which hosts social justice programming. It has been an absolute dream, like beyond anything I could have imagined. But now it's really sad. If I go to my corner on the corner of 16th and Valencia, you see a business that's completely boarded up with pieces of wood and shuttered. So obviously we're in the midst of an unprecedented economic challenge. My question to you is, how do you think that the state and the federal governments could get involved to ensure that small businesses like mine, like Manny's, can stay open and reopen and make it through this time?
First of all, I'm so proud of what you created, and I'm so sad for you that this is something you're grappling with. And we know it's happening across the country. I created a small business that I'm no longer directly involved in, but I was on a call with my former business partner, helping think about how do we avoid having to lay off our staff. And the reality is that's why we have government. Sometimes we forget, but the point behind government is it's an aggregation of resources when the ability to solve problems is larger than an individual's capacity. We understand that sometimes having each person put their little stone in the road is not enough. You need to build the road itself. You need to build the system. And that's why we have a federal government and a state government. At this moment, our federal government is not doing enough. We have good ideas that have not come fully to fruition. For example, you should be able to maintain your business with the Paycheck Protection Program. But the problem is a lot of money intended for small businesses got siphoned off by large corporations that did not need the resources. And part of the reason that happened is that Donald Trump dismantled the oversight committee and got rid of the person who was supposed to monitor how those dollars were spent. That's why voting is so critical to me. And I know it feels like I'm bringing it back on purpose, but the reality is unless we hire leaders like Joe Biden, who actually know how government should work, who built economic recovery plans and built a global health security program, if we don't have those things in place, we will never get out of this. Because yes, those who are doing okay will do better, but those who are suffering will never be able to climb out of the pit. And my belief is that this is a moment for us to remember We have a federal government, so we have a public health infrastructure so that hospitals aren't bidding against each other for basic equipment. It's why we have a U.S. post office, because for a lot of rural families, that's their only connection to the outer world. That's the only way they get their medication. The reason we have these national systems is because this is not something any person can do alone.
You talked a little bit in your opening about why you started Fair Fight and why you launched it. So thank you for that. How, with COVID-19, how has that affected the strategy and the operations of Fair Fight? And how are you going to be able to achieve your goals, given that we may still be in the situation we're in?
I knew that there was going to be an unprecedented attack on voting rights. I did not know it would be a coronavirus.
Oh, goodness.
But the reality is, no matter what the crisis is, the best organizations are nimble and responsive. We were initially designed to embed inside every state party and use the state party apparatus to expand access. That's still going on. We have MOUs with every single state party in the 18 states, and they are hard at work. We've got voter protection directors, and the work is happening. But part of the initiative was designed to let it get scaled up by the eventual presidential nominee. And so we believe that there will be a time where the DNC and the Biden campaign can scale up and expand what we do. I can go into more detail, but here's the bottom line. If you can imagine 1,000 people crowding into a precinct on election day, our mission is to get 750 of those people out of line, because that way people can spread out. If we get them to vote by mail from home, they can vote over time, and those 750 people are now safer. That leaves in place those 250 people. Well, we know about 100 of those folks are going to need to vote early because they're the shift workers who are stocking our grocery stores, those health sanitation workers who are cleaning up at the hospital, those nurses and those primary caregivers who don't know when they'll have time off, but know that they need their votes and their voices to be heard. They need to have time to vote in person early because they don't know if they'll have election day off. So if we can get that next group out, then that just leaves us with this last group of people. They have to vote in person because they are disabled, because they have language barriers, because they're homeless, because they've been displaced by COVID, because we had governors and mayors that refused to stop evictions in the worst economic crisis we have seen since the Great Depression. People who tried to vote by mail but weren't able to cure their ballots, and this is the last chance they'll have to make their voices heard. If we can get those other folks out of line, then what we leave in place are the people who need to be heard, those 150 people who want to get there and need to be there. But then we have safe and fair elections. And that's why this next CARES package is so critical. We are working hard to make sure that the Klobuchar-Wyden bill that sets the standards and the protocols for safe and fair elections is included in the next COVID package. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi vowed that she was going to make sure there was money for democracy in this next package to ensure that across this country, we have free and fair elections with vote by mail, in-person early voting, and in-person voting. That polling places don't close, and that people don't risk their lives to cast their ballots. That those absentee ballots are counted, that they can be offered with no excuses, that for every voter, that postage is paid because most people don't have stamps at home and they can't just go to the grocery store or the post office to get them. And that when you send your ballot in, that it should be counted as of the day it's postmarked, not the day it arrives.
So now we're going to get to some of our audience questions. Okay, so first we have a question from Monica in Mountain View, California. Can you speak to new innovative ways and approaches that Fair Fight is working to ensure we stay ahead of voter infringement, ahead of election cycles, and work to get legislation passed to ensure our voting rights are protected?
Part of what people don't realize is that we don't have a single uniform democracy. We've got 50 different states, which means 50 different laws, and then you add in what happens in the District of Columbia. That means there's no uniformity except that passed by federal law. And by and large, most federal laws give suggestions for states to implement. And that's like letting the fox be in charge, not only of the hen house, but of the collection of the eggs. It's never going to go the way you think. What we know we have to have is anticipation of what can go wrong and preparation for what needs to go right. That's why we launched Fair Fight 2020 in 2019, because we knew that we had to understand the system of voter suppression ahead of time. And sadly, that was innovation. What we did with Fair Fight 2020 was understand that voter suppression isn't a single act. It is a system that operates year round. It operates in every election. We just normally don't notice. But if you remember what happened in Texas, in the Texas primary, what we saw were 5-hour lines because they shut down more than 400 precincts in Black and brown communities. That voter suppression existed before that primary, and typically we wouldn't have paid attention, but it was so egregious we noticed that voter suppression happens all the time. So one of the things we are doing is making sure we're getting there early. And I know that sounds small, but we have to understand this is unprecedented. We have never had this level of voter protection in place for elections this far in advance of November. Typically what happens is that finally, after everyone's paid for all the invested in all the politicians they want to invest in, finally, they will spare some money for the voter protection people who've been waving their hands all year round. And the money shows up maybe September, probably October. We have been able to raise the funds to start the work now. And that means that we will know what to look for. The other important thing that we've done is we're also tracking what the other side is doing. We know what they're planning in part because they've said it out loud. They just didn't realize we were listening. And because we know what they're doing, we can anticipate and we can start fighting back through litigation, through legislation in the states where we can get legislation passed. But more than anything, we can do it through voter education so people know what their rights are. And we can, if we can't defeat them, we can circumvent them. And that's the plan. And there are those who would say that, well, fixing elections isn't as important as making sure that Manny's business reopens. But here's the thing. They're connected. The reason his business shut down was that the federal government, led by this incompetent buffoon, failed to do the work it should to structure government to respond to this pandemic. It's not that we didn't know it could happen. It's that we didn't have the ability to respond. New Zealand responded. Germany responded. It has been, Taiwan has responded. America has singularly failed in its obligations because we did not elect the right leadership. This is a hiring process. And when you have someone who cannot do the job, the safest thing to do is to fire that person. And that can only happen through our democracy.
Why can't every voter in America just vote by mail? I mean, like, why isn't it just the law of the land?
So the way election laws work, and this is what happened with the 15th Amendment that gave Blacks the right to vote. It's what happened with the 19th Amendment, with the 26th Amendment, 19th giving women, 16th, 26th giving young people. Every voting law that we have ever passed has delegated to the states the responsibility for implementation. That means we don't have a uniform voting system. We need one. We need there to be a floor that says you cannot be worse than this, but not limit states to do what they need to do to meet the composition of their states. For example, not everyone can vote by mail. For a number of the disabled, they have to be able to go into a polling place because the machines that allow them to complete their ballots are only accessible through a polling station. There are those with language barriers who need to be able to ask someone, not their good friend, but someone who's an expert on the issue to help them. There are those who are homeless who simply cannot receive a ballot. And there are those who are transitory. A lot of low-wage workers move from place to place, and voting by mail just isn't possible because they may not be there when their ballot arrives. There are those who are going to be displaced by COVID-19, for example. And while that is an immediate situation, we know long-term economic woes often move people around. And there are people who try to vote by mail, but because of the arcane rules or because of misunderstandings, they won't be able to. In Georgia, for example, folks have just gotten ballots. And this is something we fought for. We fought for absentee ballot applications to be sent. So we have lots of people using absentee ballots. Well, they then got their ballots and the rules and instructions tell them they have to put it inside one envelope and then inside another envelope. Only they didn't get the envelopes. Turns out that the state was wrong. They made a mistake. But there are people who aren't returning their ballots because they think they're breaking the law. And it didn't help that the Republican Secretary of State said that if you don't do this properly, we're going to accuse you of fraud. So they've intimidated voters out of using a very safe process. My point being, we need to allow people who've been confused by what can often be a complex process to go in and get it fixed. So we do need people to be able to go in person to vote. But as many people as possible who can vote by mail should vote by mail if they want to vote by mail.
Should we be concerned with possible ballot harvesting here in California? And how can we ensure that everyone who wants to vote in November can do so safely?
So ballot harvesting, or ballot collection as it is more appropriately referred to, is actually a necessary process for a lot of communities. So take, for example, Native American communities where they do not have access to regular mail service or to polling places. And many people don't have access to transportation. Being able to collect their ballots and turn them in is a safe process. Now, what we saw in North Carolina wasn't about ballot harvesting. That was election fraud. That was the buying of votes and the opening of ballots and making decisions to try to game the election. But we should not eliminate necessary access for some by responding to the terrible deeds of others. But that's why I push for all of the above. We have to recognize that not everyone can vote the same way in the United States. I live in a state that is the eighth largest state in the nation. That means we have almost 100 counties that are considered rural, which means there might be one polling place. And if somebody is disabled, if someone is elderly and doesn't have transportation, there is no bus coming to pick them up. And in the midst of COVID-19, the ability to make their voices heard may depend on people of good hearts coming to collect their ballots in safety boxes where no one can take the information out, but it can be turned in and their voices can be heard. So I support ballot collection. I do not believe it is often used for fraud. You're going to hear that specter thrown up, but the reality is those communities that use it tend to do so because of the other failures of government or simply the failure of transportation or of access. But by and large, it is a good thing and we should support it.
I have a question about COVID-19 and campaigning. How do you think COVID-19 is going to change the way candidates campaign and the way campaigns operate?
I think it's always important to be as versatile in your campaigning as possible. During my campaign, we used every tool in our toolbox. We did digital. We didn't do as many Zoom calls, but I bet if I thought about it, then we would have done those too. We did texting. We did phone banking. We did postcards. We did door knocking. And the reality is that in a moment where you cannot do the physical touch, then the next best thing is to go analog, to go back to phone banking and texting, but also to use tools like digital connection. But a big part of campaigning is not just the candidate himself or herself doing the work. It's also engaging communities to share information. And that was one thing we were very invested in. We made sure that those who wanted to support us had the resources they needed to push information out. And I think that's going to be the most effective way for campaigns, especially on the national level, to come to fruition, which is that we have to do the hard work of turning our volunteers into analog volunteers who are calling and texting. But we also need to harness those community members who are willing to reach out to their circles and expand those circles. We saw this happen before. In the 2008 Obama election, that was one of the most effective community organizing campaigns in American history, because they used the model that if you care enough to do it, you care enough to help your friends do it too. And that's what we're going to try to accomplish.
Okay, we're coming to the end here.
Yes.
So I just wanted to throw in a quick question. There's a bunch of books behind you. Can you pick your favorite book that's behind you? Maybe tell me why.
Dawn by Octavia Butler. She was one of the reasons I got into sci-fi to begin with. I think she's amazing. She's an extraordinary writer. Her mind is very, very interesting. And the stories she tells are universal and timeless.
Amazing. Awesome. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. I got to add it to my reading list.
You should.
Octavia Butler, Dawn, just so I remember. Well, on behalf of Manny's, on behalf of all the people on this call, I just want to thank you so much for the time tonight.
Manny, thank you. Thank you to everyone. Please stay safe, stay healthy, and have a wonderful evening.
Bye, Stacy.
We hope you enjoyed this installment of Welcome to Manny's. To hear previous episodes, including conversations with Mayor London Breed and author Michael Pollan, head to kalw.org. And while you're there, consider making a donation to KALW and support the programming you love and need. To check out the full roster of upcoming talks, head to welcometomannies.com. The show was produced by David Boyer, that's me, and engineered by David Kwan. Special thanks to Manny Akutiel and David Perry from Manny's and our general manager, Tina Pam-Antoine, for making this happen. We'll meet you next Friday at 5 p.m. right here on KALW.